Hey, you found Here Chicago, homegrown Chicago storytelling. We're a creative community event bringing people together from all over Chicago through food and stories. These stories are told live on the first Sunday of every month to a full Chicago theater. People who take our stage are teachers, programmers, opera singers, farmers, dancers, cab drivers, doctors, graffiti artists, and more, telling true stories with no pages, no notes. We invite five people to feature who we think you'd like to hear from and offer five open storytelling spots to our audience. We also host a giant potluck dinner, which you have to be here to share. So come visit us next month. It's even better live. Tickets and location can be found at herechicago.org. That's H-E-R-E chicago.org. Enjoy the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, she's new to the storytelling scene, and here's what she said about herself when I asked her. So tell me a little bit about yourself. She said, well, she's mostly symmetrical with asymmetrical qualities. She's learning to be open and available every single day. Ladies and gentlemen, please give her a warm round of applause, Miss Rachel Swan. Here she comes. You have to keep your applause and whooping going on. Here she comes, down the aisle. Ba, 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 ba. Come all the way up here, Rachel.
Yeah, because what's going to happen is you want all these people on the side to see you. Have fun.
So, I'm not typically one that jumps. I don't like going first, but I do know when it takes when you want to convince somebody to do something for you, it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort to get them to break their character, to get them to break tradition. When I was 18, I met a boy. Red hair, a shade lighter than mine, 1950s clothes, like he had stepped out of a Lucky Strike ad. He played harmonica in a band. That meeting turned into a wonderful friendship, but when I was 21, he got me flowers. Orange, the color of my hair at the time. And as we sat at a party, our pinkies touched back and forth. And we got drunk on the cocktail of college, Miller High Life, the champagne of beers. And I, still suffering the deafness of youth, did nothing about it. That same year, I met another boy, blonde, thin, shit-eating grin. I kissed that boy. I kissed that boy in the hallways where the redhead would walk by, not meeting my gaze as I smiled and waved. When we graduated, me and the blonde moved to DC, the redhead to Boston. Newly ordained adults on the East Coast, finding ourselves and communicating through web and wires. When I was 25, that shit-eating grin turned to a sneer. As I was left for a cookie cutter, thin, tall, blonde who wanted to be an actress and had dreams of being a mime. She also had deep pockets that could offer a security that I, the reckless redhead, with dreams yet undefined, could not give. I returned home shattered, seeking the duct tape to repair every piece of myself. And it was then that I cut off all communication with web and wires, preferring only to communicate with those who I could see face to face, because that's when I felt safe. When I was 28, I moved to Chicago. I stumbled into scenes, I laughed, I found my dreams again, and that's when I saw that boy again. Red hair, a shade lighter than mine. Gone were the 1950s clothes, replaced by 501s that still show the imprint of his harmonica in his pocket. The first time we met, after a long period of never seeing each other, he took me to Chili's, and we shared a bowl of queso. Because the line at Pizzerino Uno was too long, and he didn't think I would like deep dish anyway. Months later, I found myself in a theater, and our pinky started brushing again, and I wanted him to say it, use his words, but he didn't. And as the trains crossed in the night, I, the reckless redhead, texted him, "You could have kissed me." The next night, we're at a bar, getting drunk once again on a cocktail of college, PBR this time. And as we're walking up, and he's taking me home, our hands are touching and touching and touching, and he looks at me and he says, "Do you remember that time I got you flowers?" And I said, "Yeah, it was really odd," and he kissed me. Firm, strong, it was a foundation. And when he pulled away, he smiled and said, "You know, I think I just ran the lawn con." And I know, it takes a really long time to convince me to do anything. 12 years, in fact. But that's how I found home. And you know, I like to call that moment the biggest mistake of my life. Kinda to make him squirm a little bit, but in honesty, it's because it didn't happen soon enough. And so fast forward 2 years later, last month, I find myself in the same place that first kiss happened, and he turned around and he said, "Are you ready to make the second biggest mistake of your life?" And then he got down on one knee. And I didn't need any convincing. I said, "Sure." Thank you.
So who's this redhead? A shade lighter than yours. That's him right there. Nice. Happy endings are nice. Happy beginnings. Good. So our first feature tonight is Kevin D'Ambrosio, and he is the person that you chose or others chose last month as their audience favorite walk-up teller. Yeah, he's pretty great. He grew up in Massachusetts. He's also spent a lot of time in Chicago. He studied at I.O. and The Annoyance, those such places. He's also worked for Piven Theater, which, if you know, those of you that are familiar with theater know is like a really noble, well-respected theater company up in Evanston. And he helped create theater games classes for adults with developmental disabilities there. A few years ago, Kevin left teaching, launched himself back into performing, voiceovers, film, and as a storyteller. He also works on the other side of his life in construction management. Everybody, please give Kevin a warm welcome to the stage.
Can I not do the mic?
Oh, yeah. Fine.
You won't be on the podcast.
It's so cool to be back here again this month, so I'm really appreciative. October 2011, I was still dealing with the aftermath of a failed relationship, and I needed help. So I got myself back into talk therapy. This new therapist introduced the idea of meditating for the first few minutes of every session. I, of course, thought, why would I pay to fall asleep? But I caved, and we began. And after a few sessions of nothing, I walked in one day full and heavy of emotion, sitting right at the surface. And as I closed my eyes and we began the meditation, I felt a teardrop begin at the top of my eye. I watched the teardrop roll down the crest of my eye and fall. I felt my eyelid expand from the weight of this teardrop as it rolled down my eye and rolled down my cheek. I was so focused on that teardrop. A couple months later, I start dating someone new. We go out a few times and we have a great time. The only disappointment is that she had the same name as my mom. I love my mom. I love my mom dearly. We go out twice and we make arrangements to go out again for a third time. She said, "I will have to get back to you on, say, a Monday because I have to figure out my schedule," and I understood. Well, Monday came and went, and I started to freak out and panic. anxiety, loneliness all came back, feelings that I'm all too familiar with. And I went back to my therapist and I said, my therapist said, what would it be like for you to just let this go and focus on what's going on inside? I'm so used to in life barreling through something just to get to the other side. But at what cost? So this woman actually did get back to me and said that she apologized, that she took some extra time. Fine. I called her back and I said, I need to cancel our plans. I need to do something for myself and focus on whatever. I've got something going on. And exactly right. I burped through the whole sequence. And I said, but it sucks because I really like you. And I got ready to be scorched. And she said, I understand. Apparently, a couple years ago, she went through some similar life changes that she had to step back from. It was the first time that I really felt a compassionate ear from almost a complete stranger. Compassion I hadn't even yet cultivated for myself. We hung up the phone, the burden lifted. I grabbed my computer and I did searching on guided meditations, and I came up with something that Jon Kabat-Zinn, a talk he did at Google in 2007, which consisted of a 20-minute meditation. And he said, just for the now, let's drop into the now. Not to do anything, not to be great meditators, just for fun. And for the next month, I soared. I felt pure bliss. It was the middle of January, yet I still smelled the roses. It was amazing. I was centered. My breath was one with the universe. It was insane. And a couple weeks into it, I said, oh, I want to call her back. And I said, no, I'm going to wait a month. And I waited until the fourth week, and I called her up, and I said, I thought about stuff, and I really like you. And I want to go out if you're ready. And she was the same compassionate individual that had the conversation with me the previous month. And she said, I've started seeing someone and we really like each other. And I need to see where that goes. I hung up the phone. I understood. I wasn't expecting that though. Where I was, I came slowly back down to earth. But I continued meditating. But a year later, in the spring of 2013, I joined a Yoga Nidra class. And Yoga Nidra is a meditation sequence for people with post-traumatic stress disorder. I was born with cerebral palsy, and during childbirth, the oxygen was cut off, and I had a stroke, leaving me with a paralysis on my left side. My therapy, we started to focus on healing through trauma, and that yoga nidra really complemented what we were doing in my therapy. By October 2013, I was ready to take the next step in meditation, and I went on a 10-day silent meditation retreat. No reading, no writing, no talking, no gesturing, no phones, no keys, no car, no wallet, no TV. Just yourself. The first night, we took a vow of noble silence. We also agreed to a code of discipline. And the first code of discipline is, thou shall not kill any being. Obviously. I walk back to my room and I want to take a shower. I open the shower curtain and there lying before me is a spider. And I realize I just took that code. And I went back to my room and I thought about it. What is my next step? And then the shower head turned on. I shared the suite with another man and we shared a bathroom. He wanted to take a shower as well. And I shrieked and I thought, oh my God, I'm now an accessory to murder. And they may kick me out. But the following thought, was a purer thought. And it was the thought that life is so fragile and precious for every living thing. The next day, we started the more formal practice in which I learned to breathe for 2.5 days. That led itself into sensing all the feelings and sensations in the body. One thing I learned is the brain doesn't shut up. My brain is like the Fox News scroll. It's mostly lies and doesn't ever shut up. One day, I see a car, and it's on the road ahead, and I see, and I have the impulse to run out, flag down the car, get a ride to the nearest gas station, call my friend, have him pick me up. Then I realize I could just walk to the registration booth and get my keys and my wallet and my phone and leave. I learned a couple things. One, my breath is the end-all be-all of my being. I learned that everything arises and passes away. We all will. The things we have around us and in front of us will. Our feelings and emotions will arise and pass away. One particular thing for me is happiness. My happiness, I realize I can cultivate and harvest from within myself. And then lastly, the really big one for me is that whenever I have anything going on in life that's crazy, that's stressful, that's overwhelming, my breath is the most important thing and the only thing that matters. The very next breath I take is the only thing that matters. Thank you.
Kevin, I love that story. You know what? Especially doing, I'm in the midst of that cross-country move. My house looks like a garage sale right now. I am, what you just said, I'm going to be using and using and using. It's just my breath. I could have used that yesterday when I screamed at two poor guys in the crosswalk who were just stopped in the middle of the crosswalk, and so I stopped my car. But they wanted me to keep going, but I wanted them to use the crosswalk and continue on. And so I yelled at them at the top of my lungs. I went and had a drink later. All right. I'll remember my breath. Our next storyteller, he is a recovering attorney, right? Yes, he is in recovery from being in law practice. And he's also, he writes music. And I had to really pull this out of him. He just did not want to talk about this. But I'm fascinated by someone who on the creative talent side. And so our next performer actually wrote a musical called If I Embarrass You, Then Tell Your Friends. Is that how it is? Close enough? I was trying not to look at my paper. You said no one had heard about it anyway. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Mr. Owen Colt.
Hi. Hello. Am I using this correctly? Yes, you can hear me. Great. Okay, I never expected to become a lawyer. My college studies were all about fine arts, and unfortunately, I learned that there's a ticking time bomb, and we're all in a great deal of danger. No. Okay. I learned that I couldn't make a living at fine arts. So after, I guess about 2 years after college, I was tired of starving, and almost at random, I decided to go to law school. The other students at law school were very different than the students I had studied fine arts with. The law school students were very serious, very focused. Most of them had known for years and years that they wanted to be a lawyer. Lots of them had studied pre-law at college. And there was one other difference between me and the other law students. They understood what the professors were talking about. For me, the first few months of law school were just, it was just a haze of confusion, and I mostly kept my head down in class, praying that no professor would call on me. About 3 months into my first year of law school, I was attending a lecture. The professor's name was Professor Byrne. He was a big man with long, straight, white hair. And he brought up a new topic. He started teaching us about negligence. And much to my surprise, I started following along. I actually was understanding what he was talking about. I even realized I was leaning forward in my chair, eager to hear the next words out of his mouth. About 2 hours into the lecture, he started telling us the facts of a real case, a case out of San Francisco. In this case, a woman was suing the streetcar company, saying that she had been in an accident and that she had been harmed and that it was their fault. Let me give you the facts very briefly. She had been riding in a cable car, and the cable car was on the top of one of those huge hills they have in San Francisco, and the brakes failed because they had not been properly maintained. And the car just careened down the hill, okay? Now, the woman had not been hurt physically, so she was not suing them saying, you know, I broke my leg or something like that. She was suing them, saying that the accident had turned her into a nymphomaniac. Now, according to the case, she claimed that previously she had been a woman of conservative morals, but that in the year since the accident, she had had sex with over 150 strange men. Now, as I said, I was actually understanding the lecture, okay? And I thought of an intelligent question, a relevant, pertinent question to what the professor was talking about. And so for the very first time in my law school career, I raised my hand, okay? The professor said, "I'll get back to you." And he continued to talk about that case for the next 25 minutes, covering it up, down, left, and sideways, including covering what I wanted to ask him about, okay? Well, he had a good memory. When he finished talking, he said, "What was your question?" I didn't know what else to say. So I asked, "Do you have her phone number?" Dead silence. Not only did Professor Byrne not laugh, no one else in the lecture hall so much as snickered. And I sank into my chair and I thought, boy, am I in the wrong place. I did manage to become a lawyer and laugh, if you will. And a few years later, I heard some other lawyers talking about that famous case with the woman in San Francisco, and I learned a little interesting tidbit, which is that that famous case is commonly referred to as the Streetcar Named Desire case. Thank you.
Is that a real story? Or is that like one of those long jokes? It's true? It's so bizarre. Why do I have two microphones? All right. I have an itch. Everything's going wrong. All right. So our next feature storyteller is Marty McConnell. And Marty McConnell, as many of you may know, who are in any way aware of or savvy about the Chicago poetry scene, you will know that she is very beloved there. She's a 7-time National Poetry Slam Team member. She is the 2012 National Underground Poetry Individual Competition Champion. Yes. And she's appeared twice on HBO's Deaf Poetry Jam. Yes. Her very first full-length book, which is beautiful, it's called Wine for a Shotgun, received the Silver Medal from the Independent Publishers Awards, and it was a finalist for both the Lambda Literary Award and the Audre Lorde Award. Yes, right? Widely published in literary magazines and anthologies, including Best American Poetry of 2014, she is also the co-founder of the Louder Arts Project in New York and founder-director of Vox Ferris, which is in Chicago. They're both literary organizations that are dedicated to fusing the worlds of written and performed poetry. Please give Marty a warm welcome to the stage.
So I was trying to think over the weekend about what I wanted to do in this setting and what kind of story I might want to tell, and do I just want to sort of say a poem and then run away because I know how to do that. And so I decided not to do that and instead to try to do this. By this, I mean tell a story that is not a poem. And I was trying to figure out today what story I wanted to tell. And I was up in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, at my folks' place up there, where I grew up spending summers. And I was sitting on the lawn because I had been sitting in the garden, but the bees got really intense. So I went and sat on the lawn where there are fewer bugs. And I was sitting there and thinking about it, and I've been resisting for the last few days the notion of telling the story that I'm going to go ahead and tell, because as I was sitting there in the grass, there was this tiny, tiny slug, I mean, like this big, and I've been sitting in grass in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, not continuously, but many, many times since I was like 7 years old, and I've never seen a slug there. And this is only relevant because a few weeks ago, at the end of July, beginning of August, I had the amazing good fortune of getting to go to this place called Hedgebrook, which is a women's writers retreat center it's like an hour outside Seattle in Washington State. And at Hedgebrook, it's this gorgeous, there's like 60 acres of unspoiled land, and there are these little cabins that you get to live in for 2 to 6 weeks if you're lucky enough to go there. And it's super idyllic, and they do this thing called radical hospitality, which means they take care of you entirely. Like, they cook your food, and then they give you food to take back to your cabin to make. But it is massively populated by leopard slugs. These huge, I mean, which are like the size literally of my entire foot, these huge, huge slugs. So my whole plans of going running in the woods were spoiled because I was so scared to step on what seems like an animal. You know, I mean, it's an animal. It's not like an insect. It's a creature. So because I saw this tiny slug, I thought that I should tell some of the story of one of the things that happened while I was at Hedgebrook. So while I was there, separated entirely, you know, from the world of internet, essentially, my phone had very little signal, and there were two places you could get internet access, and I vowed I would stay off of Facebook while I was there. I mean, I was doing a good job, and then after I'd been there for almost 4 days, I went to this place called the Pump House, where you could get access to it. The Pump House that I know of is like in Texas and is a strip joint, but this is a place where they actually have pumps. It's where it pumps all the water for the retreat center. And every once in a while they kick on, and it's really, really loud and totally terrifying. But that's also where the internet is. So you go there. And so I went there, and I sat down, and I did my brief checking of email, and then I said, okay, I'll look at Facebook, but just for a minute. And I went on Facebook, and I'm, you know, scanning, and it's, you know, people's lunches and complaining about work and that sort of stuff. And then my news feed started to fill with remembrances of a friend of mine and many of ours in my news feed who had died. And she had suffered since she was an adolescent. She was 27 at the time. Since she was an adolescent, she had Lyme disease and had massive PTSD around it because she'd been wildly misdiagnosed, as happens with that, and put in a mental institution, told it was all in her head, at which point she promptly almost died, because when you have a disease ravaging your body and they decide perhaps you need Prozac, you know, you almost die. That's what happens. So over many years, she and I were dear friends in New York City. And so she had moved to Seattle, and we didn't stay in great touch, but we stayed in touch somewhat, and I knew she was struggling. But we weren't in everyday contact or even every monthly contact. And so to be sitting in the pump house in the woods alone was an extraordinary and horrible and amazing experience. She killed herself, which at the time felt even more devastating than simply knowing she had died. But this is what happens generally to people with Lyme. Generally, disease doesn't kill you. You simply are unable to go on. And so I got off the computer and I went and walked in the woods. And I did something that I didn't really realize until then that I do to stay sane in moments like this. And that was to name things that are real. So I'm walking through the woods after, of course, putting on like 3 layers of clothing, because of course then I'm like terrified I'm gonna get a tick and then get Lyme, and it's gonna be this massive irony that in mourning for my friend I get a tick, and it's just like gonna be a horrible end to the biography, you know. But so I wander in the woods and I start naming things, and I'm looking around me and I'm saying out loud, because I'm in total isolation so I can do that, tree, bush, slug. And then I stop looking at things and I just start saying things. Milk, mother, gravity, gravel, shoelaces, hair ties, people, t-shirts, buttons, necklaces, window panes, car sirens, police cars, escalators, airports, airplanes, engines, and I'm just naming these things as fast as I can to try to remain anchored. And it worked, and I got back to my cabin, and I stayed there. And then I went out to the central place where you can go get snacks any time of the day, because radical hospitality means snacks whenever you want them, which is the most amazing gift this planet can give you, basically. Snacks whenever you need them. And bottles of wine that can be purchased on the honor system. So I purchased that bottle of wine by putting my name on this little piece of paper, and then I went back to my cabin and I drank all of it. And then I woke up the next day, and I did this. This is this poem that I wrote about that. The morning of the day you were still dead, I ran my body down the asphalt road, the sun high and hot. I stood on the double yellow line on a blind curve, nobody to tell me to stop. A horse laid down in the middle of a field. 2 men in a pickup slowed to ask the way to the ferry, possibly a test of my locality. But everywhere is a home to the mad. The chickens behind their electrified fence went on pecking no matter how close I got. I would like to eat everything now. I would only love to be crazy, fairy tale crazy, crazy in 2 dimensions. But it doesn't much matter now what I want. By the side of the road There was a snake that scared me until I saw that it had no head. What kills us is almost never what scares us. But who am I telling? I stopped running because it stopped feeling like penance. The horse did not look up as I dragged past. All I could hope for was to burn.
Keep it going for Marty McConnell.
That was beautiful. And that line, what kills us is almost never what scares us. Oh, thank you for that. Beautiful. Really beautiful. It's already magical, Jana. Thank you. It always is. Well, let's continue that magic going, shall we? With our next walk-up storyteller. So he didn't know he was going to do this. We didn't know he was going to do this. Here he is tonight. Let me tell you about this guy. He has had an online dating miracle. I mean, very rare for that to happen. But he started online dating just in a month. In 1 month, he found a woman, and now they've been together for 3 months. Okay, good. And that is an online miracle dating story. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Mr. David Slattery.
What an introduction. I mean,
I only work with what I get, David.
Don't move, motherfucker. These were three words that would change my life forever. You see, it was a typical Saturday for me. I was working at a car rental place that I don't want to tell you the name of, but it rhymes with Menterprise. It was a Saturday afternoon, and it wasn't that busy, so we decided to send some workers home. And it was only myself and my coworker, whose name was Dawn, who had this real cartoon voice, and she spelled her name D-A-W-N-E, and it drove me crazy why that E was on the end. I remember it was 1998, and she was singing that Janet Jackson song, "It's All For You, It's All For You." An hour later, a man entered our store and stood about this far away from me and pointed a gun right at me. I don't know why, but I didn't feel scared. I felt a calmness about me, like I was in control. It was going to be okay. So he wanted the money, and he led me into the manager's office. So we walked around, and I kept my eye on him because I wanted to make sure I was looking at him, because I felt if I kept eye contact with him, he wouldn't shoot me. So I got down on my knees in the manager's office and opened the drawer that had the money. He didn't know this, but I only gave him the money that was probably like $200 that was on top. I didn't give him the rest of the money. And then he took the money and he ripped the phone cord out. And then he came back outside. And wouldn't you know it, two people that just wanted to rent a car happened to come in at this time. So he proceeded to take these two people and Dawn, D-A-W-N-E, into the office. And I made sure that I always kept eye contact with him and that I was the last person that he was making eye contact with. Because for some reason, I felt like if he was going to shoot somebody, I wanted him to shoot me. And he made us get down on our knees and count to 100. Two people I've never met before, Dawn, myself, with this man who all but 3 minutes ago had changed my life, putting a gun on top on me. We went down. And as I did this, I saw him slowly start to close the door. And I went down and I exhaled. And I knew at that moment that we would be okay. Unfortunately, the after effects of this is nobody was hurt. But Dawn had to go to a different location. She could never work in that office again. All the big bosses had come in and said, David, the next day it's Sunday. Do you want to go home? And I said, I would love to go home. But I'm not going to give somebody power that comes in and puts a gun on me and going home. So I am staying. 1 week later, across the street from us, there was a robbery. Three people were shot and killed. Fifteen years after this incident, last year, I'm working at a different corporate job. There's a jam in the printer. I go and I put the paper in, and as the printer is warming up, our company newsletter is next to it. And there it was. D-A-W-N-E. We work at the same company again. I didn't know this. I froze when I saw that name. And I emailed her right away. And I said, Dawn, you might remember me. We shared something personal a long time ago. She responded in about 30 seconds. David, of course I remember. I will never forget. You saved my life that day. I got some closure because Dawn and I decided to go out and discuss that event. We went out to a restaurant. And here's the crazy part. Nobody came in and robbed the restaurant. She still had that cartoon voice. 15 years had passed, and finally, I was able to discuss this incident with her after all these years. But you see, what that robber didn't realize is he came in to rob us of money, but what he really did is he robbed me of part of my life. Thank you, everybody.
All right. So our next feature teller right now is Jack Thurston Farrell, which is the regalest damn name in Chicago. Jack is a graduate of the University of Wisconsin in Madison with a degree in film and psychology. He's written and produced for ABC, Fox, and Jim Henson Productions. Oh, I want to hear that story sometime. He teaches at the Second City Training Center for the teen and youth programs, and he hosts The Bucket Show with himself and Wolfgang Stein, who is also here tonight. Where's Wolf? There he is, right there. And this is a really beautiful show. It's, what is it, first Thursday of every month, and it's at Uncommon Ground, and it's a really nice vibe. It's like a really warm show. It's super creative. It's storytellers, improvisers, and musicians. So it's Uncommon Ground in Wrigleyville. What did I say, first Thursday? First Thursday of the month. Jack also has produced a web series called Couch Surfers, and that's in the Chicago Comedy Film Festival. Please give him a warm welcome to the stage.
Thank you. I spent every summer traveling down to Hixson, Tennessee. Hixson, Tennessee is a small town outside of Chattanooga, Tennessee, which gives you an idea of how small Hixson, Tennessee is. My grandparents lived on the 15th hole. It was called Valley Brook Golf Course. And they lived in a one-level house. And if you walked out their back door, you would be met by the 15th fairway. And then if you hit a nice high 5-wood draw over the oak tree, you'd have a pitching wedge left, which meant that it was a birdie hole for those that played a lot. I played a lot. I could probably get in 4 rounds per day if no one wanted to play with me, which was usually the case. On that golf course, I learned a lot. I learned how to smoke cigarettes, put $2 into the cigarette machine, and you pull the little knob, and a pack of Marlboro Reds comes out. And I'll tell you, Marlboro Red smoke stings pink lungs like a Mack truck into a toy train. The smoke will hang in the humidity with all its stubbornness. When I would smoke those cigarettes, I'd smoke them away, away, away from the course, away, away from the house. They would hit me so hard that sometimes I'd have to lay down because the smoke was so intense. Valleybrook Golf Course had an interesting cast of characters. There was the man that washed the carts, and his name was Pokey. My grandparents called him James because they felt Pokey was racist. They used to march for civil rights in the 60s. There was a dog that walked around. His name was Tripod, and he had 3 legs. Front leg, one of his front legs were missing. And Tripod got to go where no one else could go. He got to go into the pro shop and into the dining area. And these are places where I wasn't allowed to go as a kid. The only time I was allowed to go there was with my grandfather. He had the power. I'd follow him into the pro shop, and I remember sticking my dirty, grubby little hands into the golf tees and packing my pockets full of golf tees until when I would walk, the golf tees would stab my thighs. If I was lucky, at the end of the round, I got to have a Sprite in one of the fancy glasses with ice in the air-conditioned room on the padded seats at the bar with as many refills as I wanted. And I couldn't do this if my grandpa wasn't there. My grandpa didn't get along with everybody at the club. He was, and in hindsight, he was an intellectual. And the good old boys in Chattanooga, Tennessee, namely wanted to talk about tax loopholes and high school sports. My grandpa didn't really care for those topics. He wanted to sit next to his wife in his living room and read National Geographic and talk about anthropology or sociology. And then about an hour after dinner, he'd fall asleep in the glove, which was his chair. He spent a lot of time in his study listening to Cab Calloway and Etta James, Duke Ellington. He would tally all the scorecards for all the people in the whole country club and figure out everyone's handicaps. He was very fastidious and almost anal retentive. He kind of had to be. His mother died when he was 10, and he went on to graduate from Northwestern and then get a PhD from UCLA. He was the man with the power. What power? The power to hoodoo. Hoodoo? You do. Do what? Look like the man? What man? The man with the power. Bill Miller was also among this cast of characters. Bill would re-grip your whole set of clubs for a dollar a club. And if you walked into his house, it smelled like cream corn. And his wife looked like she had pillow implants in her cheeks. He'd say, if you went golfing with him, that you lost your golf ball, he'd say, they make them every day. Which meant it's not that big a deal. doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. It's not that important. Nothing was that important. Down there during those summers, my sister and I, except for my grandpa, he would take me out on the golf course. And before we went out, we would define words that were on the refrigerator. My grandpa would put words on the refrigerator in those little color letters. And we would have to define them. And after that, we'd walk around Valley Brook Golf Course. And he created this magical world for me. He'd say that if the rivers were dirty, he'd say the milkman has been here. Or he'd say there's crocodiles in the water. Or there's wild animals in the forests. We'd walk around and we'd find golf balls everywhere, in the riverbeds, in the forests. And one summer, he painted a golden golf ball and he hit it on the golf course. And he said, I've heard a rumor around the club that someone lost a golden golf ball at the beginning of the summer. And by the end of the summer, I got to find that golden golf ball. By the time I was a teenager, I was bigger than my grandpa, much bigger. I could hit a golf ball farther than my grandpa, which made him feel emasculated. And I started to have the power. What power? The power to hoodoo. Hoodoo? You do. Do what? Look like the man. What man? The man with the power. My sister and I would travel down to Tennessee every single summer and every single winter. And we'd travel down Illinois through Kentucky. We'd stop at Cracker Barrel and eat biscuits and gravy. And my dad said, if you see a white horse, you get a dollar. Because in Kentucky, according to my dad, it's good luck to see a white horse. My girlfriend and I, Anna, recently took a trip down to see my grandparents down in Chattanooga. And now they stay in this beautiful Alexian Brothers village. And we sat and had dinner with them. My grandma was seated in her chair with her homemade mariachi hat on, where she had sewn mariachi little hangies all over her hat. She was in a pinstripe sports coat. It looked like she was stealing something out of Sinbad's closet. As we carried on with dinner, I realized that they didn't have the faculties that they did at one point. My grandpa told me a couple stories about how he's been hit on by a lot of people in the nursing home. And how my grandma had been banned from the dining area because she refused to put on anything more than her sports bra. The next day, we got to drive around the Alexian Brothers golf course, and I could see the delight of my grandpa's face when I pointed out there's golf balls in the fairway, and he said he couldn't see them anymore. When we got back to his room, Anna put a CD in a CD player, and we played Etta James's A Tisket, A Tasket, and he sang along. I realized that I only got to see a little bit of my grandpa when I went back to Chattanooga. On the way home in the car to Chicago, Anna and I were driving through Kentucky, and we're driving into the sun, and there's a silhouette of two horses, and we passed under the bridge, and before we passed under the bridge, Anna said, hey, two white horses. And by the time I turned around and looked, two white horses were gone. Thank you.
Blackjack. Hoodoo. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I'm going to see if my husband and I can use that in the grocery store now, from now on. Hoodoo. Hoodoo. God, at least I can find you guys now. All right, you guys ready for our next walk-up storyteller? Because I know I am. I remember I met her for the very first time a couple years ago right here at this show. She told a story, and she was phenomenal. I don't know that she's been back since then, but she's wonderful. She has? All right. Well, thanks for keeping tabs on her, guys. Ladies and gentlemen, she tells me, and I know this to be true, she is a survivor. And she's also a mom. She says that's her favorite job in the world, and she loves those kids to pieces. Ladies and gentlemen, please bring to the stage Miss Kelly, sweetie, honey, pieces, lovey, pieces!
Thank you. Okay, so a couple of years ago, I was at this different storytelling event, and they have these kind of cool chairs that are more like stools. And because I was just so excited about storytelling, I love it, okay? I was kind of hanging off the edge of my seat. They were telling a story about tantric sex. And, oh, goody, I had never seen this before. They were doing a demonstration. So I was really like, wow. I didn't want to miss any of this. So truly, I was hanging off the edge of this seat cushion. And that caused an embarrassing after moment. So some people that are here were there. But anyway, I did what I do when I get really embarrassed about something. I tell my mama. So I may be older than I look, but something about being humiliated and embarrassed just like reverts me totally back to childhood. So I'm in the car with my mom and I'm like, Mom, you won't believe this. I went to that storytelling event and I was just so excited and I was hanging off the edge of my seat. And then the next guy, when they called his name, he got up there and he told everybody, you might want to close your legs because I saw your pussy. What? And he made sure everyone in the room knew he was talking about me. Okay. You know, I'm one of those don't let them see you sweat type of people. So I was like, at the time. Then he says, or maybe it was your stomach. So, you know, I told my mama because all my life I wanted, you know, my mama to stick up for me. I wanted her to get mad like them other mamas in the hood that's like, hey, don't nobody do nothing like that to my baby. What did he do? Who did he think he was embarrassing you like that? Okay, where he live? You know, that's how I get down for my sons. They'll tell you after the show, honey. Look, okay, I got this cane. You do something to my baby, honey, it's over. But my mom isn't like that. My mom kind of sort of has some different priorities, like with language and like not speaking Ebonics. And so she's protective of me, but she was always protective of me in that way. She didn't want me to appear too ghetto or uneducated. So, like, when I was 3, while other children were saying, oh, I have to tee-tee, I have to pee-pee, I have to wink-wink, she had me say urinate. So, I'm in the car. Mommy told everybody he saw my pussy. I can't believe it. And I want her to get so upset. But no, she gets upset at me. I think she's ready to pull over. Kelly, I do not like that word, pussy. Huh? Really? Mom, do you know people are actually starting to get it to to know who I am? Do you know how embarrassing that is? And he told everybody. I don't even know who he was. And he told everybody that he saw my pussy. Kelly, I don't like that word. I remember when you first learned that word. Oh, I hated it. I remember when I was in the bedroom and you and your sister were in the bathtub together. Hold up. Me and my sister was in the bathtub together? Okay, this was back in the day. Maybe I'm aging myself, but they used to let little kids take a bath together, et cetera. And okay, so we're in a bathtub together. I'm like, for real? Okay, so we're in a bathtub together, and she says, all of a sudden, I heard the most horrific thing. And I'm like, what? We was in the bathtub together? Something horrific happened? What happened? What? She's like, I heard... Little sister, you better get your pussy out of my face. And I was like, for real? She's like, oh, it got worse. Oh, you better get your pussy out of my face. No, you better stop putting your pussy in my face. Kelly, I was horrified. I was horrified. How did you get to learn that word? She said, but I believe that when children are doing bad things, you just ignore them and then it'll go away. But she said, all I kept hearing was pussy this and pussy that and pussy, pussy, pussy. And she said, I couldn't take it anymore. I barged down that bathroom door and I said, stop. It is not called a pussy. It is a vagina. But me being the tough chick that I am, I was like, well, Mom, Stank said that it's a pussy. I know y'all are like, Stank? Well, Stank was an older girl that lived in the neighborhood. I grew up kind of in the hood. They had names like Junebug and D-Lo and Poo Bud and Bingo and Boogie, and then there was Stank. It was a little different, but it was the hood. They had these nicknames. So she was like, Stank, yes. Now I'm authority on pussy because Stank told me. Stank said it's called a pussy. So my mom said she just decided to go out of the door and ignore us again and continue to teach us to use the word vagina. But what I learned from that story is that if it stank, then it's a pussy. If it's clean, it's a vagina. Thank you.
Similar to Owen's story about the question about the Streetcar Named Desire case, I am curious about whether this is a real story.
Oh, yeah. I thought
about not using her real nickname,
but that is
her person. I don't know. That's an amazing punchline, then, to your story. Wow. See, magic. Magic. Awesome. Amazing. All right. Our last featured storyteller is Abraham Malish. And I first saw him and met him at an event that we were both performing at that was a fundraiser and a creative community event. And he's an amazing musician. He's an acoustic musician influenced by Bob Dylan, Tracy Chapman, Lucky Dube, Fela Kuti. He has his own sound. It combines Western folk, funk, blues with an African pulse. He has seen a lot in his 22 years. Abraham survived the atrocities of two civil wars in his home country of Monrovia, Liberia. And after spending some time in the United States recovering from that, both mentally and physically, he directed all of his energies toward being a musician, and we are luckier for that. He was recently the featured musician in Live in the Lounge at the Chicago House of Blues. And his goal is to promote self-realization through music. Let me just ask you really quick, how do we need the mic set up here? Do you want like one for the guitar and one for your voice? Okay. So could someone grab and help me? Thank you so much. Hey, thanks. And then once we have this set up, thanks. Thank you, guys. We'll give Abraham a warm welcome to the stage, please.
Hey there. I wish I had a good, awesome story for you. I'm kind of mostly in the moment guy, but coming here, I remembered a friend, and I figured I should do a show for him. So there's two songs I'm gonna play for you. It's gonna be for a guy called Chris Spinnick, you know? So you take from this what you need. Christopher Pinnick I met when I started attending a community college in Glen Ellyn, studying child development. And he was a product of American adoption system or what have you not. And he had gone through a lot, you know, in LA. He'd been, you know, abused by, you know, by family and thrown onto movie scene. You know, he did good. And then, you know, jump homes from homes. But Christopher Pinnick was a good friend of mine. You know, he had good ways for words. He was a very witty man. I desperately wanted Chris to have happiness. I wanted to be his family. Desperately wanted to be his friend. So we both, at one point in time, went homeless, and me and my guitar, it opened so many doors for me. It was nothing for me to get a place to stay, but so I asked Chris to the people to have Chris move in there with me, and they said yes. You know, Chris liked the marijuana, so the next thing you know, I get called to the table saying, "Oh, Abraham, you guys have to go." I'm like, why? Like, why? But I later find out it was because of what Chris did, you know. Another funny story, and this is just me remembering, just me remembering Chris, and it hasn't been that long. We went down to NIU to meet up with my friend West, who was graphic designer. Next thing you know, we're walking there, and Chris just does the most random thing ever. But I love this guy, you know. He runs through the entire dorm, knocking people door, you know. And there's a name for that type of behavior. It's called nigger knocking. It's quite interesting. you know, he just had so much life. You know, when I went to Texas and I did my recording, I came back. You know, Chris, you know, it's so hard in America not having a friend or not having family. I could see how with all the resources the country has, you know, there are still people who, you know, in isolation will commit such horrible crime, you know, and do such horrible things. It's a horrible thing, you know. Chris, I came back and Chris needed money because he didn't have a place to stay. So I took $500 that I earned and I gave it to Chris. And he would say he was going to pay me back. And wherever you are, Chris, just know I don't want the money back, man. I just want to be your friend, you know. He didn't pay me back, and he ignored my messages. Hey, are you okay, man? What's up, man? Nice message. Mad message. But eventually, Chris said something on Facebook. He tried to kill himself, and then eventually he tried to fake his death. And then I got a random call from jailhouse, but et cetera, et cetera. But these are the songs that I play that Christopher like, and wherever he is, you know, I hope he's able to settle and allow love to happen in his life, you know?
All right, so when it's called Soulja Boy. Trouble they'll come, trouble they'll go, oh, tell me something I don't already know. I don't know how she did it, to how this did. Oh yeah, yes I'm indebted, is the least I can say. Least I can say, it's me, I'll be a soldier boy. From my mind, oh my mind, I will be a strong young man. Oh papa, oh papa, whatever you say. I write, I give my heart to you. Now your eager eyes brings out the best of me. One thing's for sure, in the end, all eyes will close. So when I write, yeah, see I give you my heart. And I give you my heart and soul. With me, I be a soldier boy. Oh, my mind. Oh, my mind. I will be a strong young man. For papa. Oh, papa. Whatever you say, and I will do whatever you say. And I go do. Tell me run, how far you tell me duck. I say how low. I'm a soldier for my mother, soldier for my father. Soldier for my brothers, soldier for my people. Oh, my people. Soldier today, soldier tomorrow. Soldiers we stay. Soldiers forever, forever. It's me, I be so. Boy, from my mind, oh my mind, I will be a strong young man. For papa, oh papa, miss me, I'll be a soldier boy. Oh my mind, oh my mind, I will be a strong young man. For papa, oh papa. Lion man, I see no evil, and I fear no evil. Fight fire, fire. I fight fire, fire. I'm a soldier boy for mama, oh mama. I will be a strong young man, oh papa, oh papa. Whatever you say.
Valentine's. Okay, cool. All right, cool. I'll play one of Chris' other song that he liked.
This one's called Find Somebody.
Yeah. It's just so funny. I always find it funny how these songs affect different people. I'm thankful to God that I can write music that, you know, people can vibe to, and of the hood feel, or have you not, and people can think about, and very, very grateful. You know, so I didn't understand it. I didn't understand, you know. I actually thought it was a country song. Tired of the ordinary, feeling sorry, let down by false promises. They kicked aside, but wasn't fit to coexist. But I hold no grudges, I hold no grudges. Now time has passed, I see you for what you really are. I made up my mind, and there's no turning back. Say, I know you find somebody when I'm gone. And I know you find someone to fill me in when I'm gone. Don't be sorry, it's only temporary. She said, flip a coin, we can take a chance. Wherever we may land in this life, this life. Hold it in my hands. I tell your friends I'm impatient, inconsistent, not up for the challenge. You're telling the same old lies. You're singing the same old song. Sing is over, it's over. You're telling the same old lies. Over, singing the same old song. It's over and over. Yeah, I know you'll find somebody when I'm gone. And I know you'll find someone. Feel me, yeah. And I'm gone. Don't be sorry, it's only temporary. When I'm gone, don't be sorry, it's only temporary. La 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 la, la. Don't be sorry, it's only temporary. Cause I know you'll find somebody when I'm gone.
Temporary. Oh, don't be sorry. I love it. Oh, man. You're real nice, Jana. I was going to take that car. Ladies and gentlemen, you ready for our final walk-up storyteller? Yes! This guy's so interesting. I asked him to tell me a little bit about himself, and he paused for just a second. And he said, well, you know what? I founded a tech company accidentally. And I was like, wow. I lost my keys accidentally. So we're a little different there, Clay. Yeah, he started a tech company for bicycles and theft resistance in bicycles. So if you ever have a bike that's stolen, you probably want to talk to Clay. Ladies and gentlemen, please bring him up with a round of applause. Clay Nair!
Thank you. So my name's Clay Nair, and I'm originally from Los Angeles, California. And after the giant earthquake in Los Angeles that nearly destroyed basically everything I knew, my dad decided to spin the globe once, and he hit water. Spin the globe a second time. Hillsboro, North Carolina. Not just Hillsboro. Historic Hillsboro, North Carolina. So me being a slender and cosmopolitan Jewish kid, suddenly asked to enjoy the South. Enjoy the really, really historic South. Enjoy! Enjoy. So we get there, first few weeks in, Hurricane Fran happens. Basically almost destroys that house that we're in. But this is not the story I'm here to tell. My dad noticed that I wasn't really leaving my room that much because I sort of didn't want to be there. And I basically would communicate to my parents through the door by saying, when are we leaving? Are we going back to LA? Like, tonight, tomorrow? When's good? I hate it here. I hate it here. I don't know anybody, neither do you. And there's no reason for us to be here. It's the middle of the summer in the deep South, and everything is sticking to my leg and biting me. And sometimes biting the thing that's sticking to my leg. So my dad wakes me up one day. He's like, son, guess what? I signed you up for the basketball league. Now, in Los Angeles, I did play basketball a bunch, and I was okay. I wasn't the kid to get the ball for the buzzer beater, but I wasn't going to be embarrassing. I wasn't going to be someone that you would feel ashamed of. So I said no a couple of times, but then I realized my dad had all the cards and he had the food and the house. And so I realized that I didn't have much choice. Now, the rec league gym was, I'd say, four houses down from my old historic Hillsboro-y house. And so I walked up there, and inside the gym were the kids practicing around the cones and things like that. And, you know, I was a pretty good athlete. Let me just say this. But that night, the night I needed it most, I was terrible. I mean, unbelievable. Like the Harlem Globetrotters, like I was the captain of the other team. Like the ball was bouncing off my face and going through my legs, but not in a cool way. I was really, 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 really bad. Really, really, the worst I've ever done in sports, period. And it was like out of the movies, the kids were laughing at me, and even the adults were like, you know, putting the clipboard over their faces and giggling. And it was the first time I'd never made a team. I mean, like, it was just like, whoa! And so I go back, it's in the evening, I go back to my house, and I just race inside, and I'm, like, sort of crying, but it wasn't okay to cry when you're 13 and you're a guy. And so I just ran upstairs, and I was like, I'm never leaving my room! And so my mom comes up to the door, and she's like, how did it go? I was like, terrible! Everything happened! The ball hit me, and they were laughing, and I'm never leaving my room! And so I go to sleep, thinking that for sure there'll be a U-Haul truck and a sign that says, all right, Clay, you win, we're going back to L.A. But no, my dad woke me up, and he said, get out of bed. He was mad at me. I had just been destroyed in basketball the night before. He's like, get out of bed. Get out of bed. I signed you up for a ping pong tournament. And I was like, what? A ping pong tournament? Are you kidding me? It's going to be the same people. Like, I'm never going over there. I'm never going east in my life again. I would have to see what it's like on the west. Because that east of the house is that horrible gym with the mean people and the really fucked up adults that would laugh at a kid that just, anyways. So, again, he reminded me that he did have all the food, and he also had the house, and the video game access, and all the things that were really important to me. So, he takes his paddle, and he was quite good at ping pong, and he slams it in my hand, and I open the door to the historic house, and I look up the street, and it's like out of an old Western. It's just like, it looked a million miles away, even though it was like three houses down, and it was just, whoosh, dust ball. And so I'm dragging my paddle, which feels like it weighs like 1,000 tons, up the street, you know, just this lone little sad cowboy forced to play ping pong and embarrass himself. Maybe there'll be girls this time that can make fun of me too. And so I get in, the double doors open, the little metal door that clicks open, kind of similar to the entrance here. And I look up, and it's the entire cast from the previous evening, including the really shitty adults that laughed at me. And so all the kids are snickering. They're like, oh, here's this idiot. Here's this L.A. kid. You know, what's he going to do? And they're all playing, you know, warming up, playing ping pong and all this kind of stuff. And I walk up to the registration desk, and I look at the guy, and he's kind of snickering as I walk up. And I'm like, is there a trophy if you win? And they're like, ah! Son, you be playing for pride. Woo! trophy. You're worried about a trophy? All right, so they put my name on the bracket. You know, I let them have their laugh. I say nothing else. I look off into the distance, though, and I see this mound of a person. It's just gigantic guy. And it's Big Nate. So I come to hear. I don't ask. But this is the guy that all the kids believe will just take the tournament. They're just, you know, everyone likes to play. You know, it's fun to get this far in the tournament, but Big Nate's going to win, you know? Big Nate was so big that when he was holding the paddle, it looked like one of those, like, free tastes at the ice cream parlor. Like, that's how big the paddle looked in Big Nate's hands. It's just, he was playing with a sample spoon. Whatever. I didn't want to hear about it. I knew that I actually was pretty good at ping pong. So I go through the tournament, and you can imagine like a montage with like video game music, and you know, I'm going through the rounds, and like all these kids are being vanquished by me, and like moving up the bracket, and everything's getting good. And so all these kids are like, damn, LA kid can play some ping pong. Like, what's going on here? And so they start watching my matches and start taking shots at me and making fun of me and be like, oh, it's whatever, man. Kyle's going to beat you. David's going to beat you, whatever. And I just start beating Kyle and beating David and not saying a word and just being angry, just like this little kid. And so I make it to Nate, championship round. Who would have thought? Me versus Nate. L.A. kid, skinny little Jew kid, no, doesn't know anybody. And then Big Nate with the little sample spoon. And so we begin playing, and point one goes, and, well, let me just skip to the end. I beat the shit out of Nate. I just beat the fucking shit out of him. I just clowned him. Oh! But I didn't say a word. I was just, every point, I was just, in my head, like, everything was just like, yes! Yes, more! Lose more, Nate! Lose more! But I just kept, just this, nothing, not responding to anybody. And nobody could believe it. Nobody could believe it, but I could believe it. And I walked by that registration table at the end, not saying a word. And I basically just sort of signed my name in the championship thing, and that's it. I just walk off. I'm walking away, walking to those double doors. And this kid, he's like, hey, what are you, Forrest Gump or something? And I go, my name's Clay Nair. I live down the road. And I shut the doors, and that's it. And that's my story.
Wow. What a closer.
I'm Clay Nair. I live down the road.
The night. That was awesome.
It was really great.
All right, you guys, so pull out your little piece of paper. Mm-hmm. That's it for our storytellers. We want to just kind of have each one of the walk-up tellers stand up so that you can remember who they are and give your points according to who you would like to see return as a feature with a longer storytelling spot next month.
Remember, you have 50 points. Only 15 can go to any one storyteller. Here you are. Rachel, will you stand up, please? Give a big shout out for Rachel. Owen, stand up over here. David Owen. Slattery, right here.
David, right here.
Kelly, right here.
Wait, who? What? What'd you say? I just didn't hear you.
Oh, that's Kelly, right here.
Kelly, right over here.
Right there. And Clay.
I'm Clay Nair. I live up the road.
All right.
You guys, that was a beautiful show. Thank you so much. Always with this show, we don't dictate theme because themes that are more interesting than any themes that we could otherwise have dictated emerge. So that's something I encourage you all to reflect on if you are so interested in that sort of a thing. And please, if you like, stay and enjoy each other. Talk to someone who told a story that was in any way enjoyable or moving to you. That's why we're here. Put your voter sheets on the stage right there tomorrow night. The person that you give the most points to and the walk-up teller for next month's show will be announced, so please check the website. There's that little bookmark that when you came in, you all tried to give to me, and then I said, no, that's for you. That has our website address on it so that you can find out who is in the next lineup next month and who you pick to come back. So please give yourselves a round of applause. You guys, wonderful.
You guys
show.
Are great.
Thank you so much.
That's our show this month. Join us again next month for more Stories Told Live. A rotating cast of volunteers makes Here's Chicago go. You can see their names, along with all of the names of our storytellers and co-hosts, at hereschicago.org. If you're in Chicago and would like to take part, the best thing to do is come down and meet us. Visit the website to find location and to view photographs, potluck recipes, and show history. Mary Kate Walthall is our house manager. Molly Emmons is our box office manager. Matthew Williamson is our photographer and sound producer. Here's Chicago is hosted and produced by me, Janice O'Bell. Thanks for listening.